You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
All right, just a quick note here. We're revisiting a conversation that we had earlier this year that's all about reproductive and sexual anatomy. In this segment, we're going to be using some pretty frank and anatomically correct language.
Now, there's no doubt about it. Many of us are more than a little uncomfortable talking about female anatomy.
The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
In polite company, we resort to obscuring euphemisms rather than simply saying vagina, clitoris, uterus, ovaries. But our collective squeamishness has consequences, negatively affecting sexual and reproductive health for centuries. Luckily, it's a problem with a solution.
My name is Rachel E. Gross. I'm a science journalist and the author of Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage.
Rachel's book looks at the historical dis, miss, and lack of information about the bodies of people with vaginas, which includes women, trans men, intersex people, and non-binary people. In the introduction of her book, Rachel describes conversations she had with multiple scientists who tried to explain why we understand so much less about female anatomy and vaginas compared to male anatomy and penises.
When pressed, he and others acknowledged that this discrepancy, at its heart, is due to sexism within science and who is actually doing the investigating. For most of history, women, especially women of color, trans women, and women who are sexual minorities, have been excluded from this supposedly universal endeavor. As I reported this book, it became clear to me that the two problems were inseparable. The marginalization of women's bodies from science is largely due to the marginalization of women from science. So I'd already been thinking about a lot of these issues. I've been thinking a lot about what women and minority scientists are up against because I was running a column on unsung women in science at Smithsonian Magazine, and because I had written a lot about reproductive science and animal sex. But as I mentioned in the book, I also got a vaginal infection while I was working as an editor. That was really annoying, and it kept coming back. And it turned out it was not a UTI or a yeast infection, as my gynecologist originally thought. It was something called bacterial vaginosis, and literally 1 in 3 women before menopause have it. So I was like, this is really common, this sucks, but there must obviously be an easy treatment for it. No, there was not. My gynecologist told me that if the antibiotics didn't work, then it basically could keep coming back, and it often did. And the only last resort was something called boric acid, which she described as rat poison. And the container that it came in actually had a skull and crossbones. I still have it. And it says, poison, do not ingest by mouth, keep away from pets and children. So somehow I was able to put this substance in my vagina, but not my mouth. And I was just following directions, and kind of I trusted medicine and science, but I honestly didn't know how it was working or why I had to do this or what the substance really was. And that all became very apparent to me one night when I was very tired. It was 3 a.m. and I realized I'd forgotten to do this insertion thing where you insert a capsule into your vagina and kind of lie on your back and think about what you've done. So so I basically was in the bathroom and I was holding this capsule. It looks just like an antibiotic. And I put it in my mouth and I swallowed it without thinking. And that's when I had this really visceral realization. I was like, oh my God, what even is this? Why did I agree to this? It's something called acid. And I look it up online and it says, call the poison control if you ever ingest this. People have died from swallowing it. And I was like, oh my God. So I ended up in the emergency room and I ended up being fine. But that whole time I thought I was going to have my stomach pumped. I honestly thought I might die because one of the first Google responses was about somebody dying from ingesting, it turns out, a lot of boric acid. And it just got me thinking about how much trust I really had put in medicine and about how little medicine clearly knew about body parts like mine and about how little I knew about my own vagina as a science reporter and person ostensibly who loved vaginas.
One should never judge a book by its cover, but let's start with your cover. Tell me about the beautiful artwork there.
I actually hope people will judge this book by its cover. The cover kind of gives a sci-fi fantasy journey feel. It was designed and created by Armando Veve, who's an incredible artist who does a lot of science fiction. And it is kind of this world on the edge of the water that is rife with vaginal and female body symbolism, but sort of turned upside down. So there's a pitcher plant eating a sperm dragonfly. There's a kind of coy duck because we get into duck genitals later in the book. There's actually an Easter egg. There's a clitoris flying that we call the clitorodactyl in the background. That's for eagle-eyed readers. And it really is supposed to give this impression of a journey into a really wondrous and new and sometimes alien land. And there are little signs that there already have been explorers here before. So there's like a little ship and a crumbling pillar that are kind of these vestiges of really the colonialism of the female body.
And just one more beat on this, because art matters a lot. The rendering of the vagina, even in medical renderings, the notion that it's a place where we should look, right? Both look with scientific inquiry, but actually also look, like sometimes with a mirror in your restroom, in your own house. Talk to me about the importance of even being able to make an accurate rendering of women's anatomy.
Yes, that's right. A huge theme in this book is that you only see what you expect to see, and you can't see what you aren't looking for. And that mostly comes up when we're talking about these older, usually male anatomists who are looking at female bodies and kind of expecting to see something. So they expected the female body to be reproductive, to be mostly about the uterus, to not really have that big a capacity for pleasure or for kind of active dynamic processes going on. So what they illustrated was very passive, kind of a hole or a cave. The word vagina actually means a sheath, which suggests that its main role is to house a penis, which it is not. So there definitely is a reimagining going on by a lot of new scientists. And you can see that in the art throughout the book. Every chapter opens with an illustration that really looks at these organs in a new way, usually one that is active, dynamic, and resilient.
We're going to take a quick break here. More of my conversation with Rachel E. Gross about her new book when we get back.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're back with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're continuing our scientific voyage into the history of the vagina with Rachel E. Gross, a science journalist and author of the book Vagina Obscura. Rachel and I talked about the historical roots of shame about the vagina.
Unfortunately, the idea of shame has really impacted the way that science, medicine, and people with this anatomy have viewed the, quote, female body. So there's a really strong pattern going back to Hippocrates of anatomists really insisting on naming these body parts after shame, especially the clitoris and the vulva. So Hippocrates called all the genitals the shame parts, essentially, but that continued. So every time like a French anatomist would, quote, discover the clitoris, you would name it the shame part. And even today you have words like Schamlippen in German, which means the shame lips and refers to the labia. And you have pudendum, which is an anatomical term that's hopefully being phased out, but it means the parts for which you should be ashamed. And again, it refers to only the vulva. So shame has really attached itself to the female genitals in particular, and that has affected the way science is done. There is a hesitancy of looking directly at this part of the body. There is a tendency to associate it with danger, sexuality in a negative light, kind of the threat of pregnancy and STDs and disease. And it's really blocked us from looking at the incredibly kind of unexpected and expansive things that this system is doing. So the ovaries are producing hormones that support body-wide health, from like bone health to heart health to brain health. And the uterus is one of the most regenerative organs in the body. And when it's not pregnant, just going through monthly menstruation, it's ushering stem cells and immune cells to heal this wound painlessly. It's creating new blood vessels. And it's doing this every month on cue. And it's probably has a lot to teach us about regenerative medicine in general. But having looked at these organs with themes like shame and only reproduction in mind has really narrowed the view.
One of the things that's extraordinary about the book is the interweaving of scientific discovery, history, but also narrative, that we're able to take this journey into the vagina, in, around, and through the clitoris, understanding the uterus, the ovaries, but often with a pal, right? So sort of following on this path. Tell me a little bit about making the choice to bring us these stories in that way.
The first thing I want to mention is, yes, these are many, many stories about women, girls, and people who identify as female, but there are also trans women and intersex people in this book who are also explorers and also figuring out their own bodies and who also have these body parts. So I really did make an effort to be as expansive as possible and to kind of break down some of those binaries we often attach to the quote reproductive system. Yeah, so making this story narrative, which I mean as grounded in the lived experiences and the hunger for knowledge that many of these scientists and patients had, was really critical to me. This is important because these diseases, these organs, and this biology matters intimately to people. It matters to their lives. It matters to their relationships, to their bodies. And these are some of the people for whom it was the most critical to understand. People who struggled with diseases like endometriosis, people for whom menopause had an extremely important role in their family, people who were transitioning and seeing how scientists around them and the rest of society viewed their gender identity and how it was actually blocking them from doing better science.
What mysteries still exist when it comes to the vagina?
Oh my gosh. So many. In a way, this book was not about chronicling like the new science of the vagina and all its companions. It was really chronicling this like little peak of a growing movement to reimagine them and kind of the start of a lot of interesting science being done. So the ovarian stem cells that we mentioned, that's still in its infancy, I would say. We're not able to like make use of these insights yet. We're not able to see inside the female body to look at ovaries across the lifespan yet. And I'm really excited to see what in 10 years we do learn about how regenerative and resilient ovaries truly are, and about whether terms like ovarian failure and ovarian exhaustion need to be phased out and replaced. For the vagina, I was super fascinated by the vaginal microbiome, partly because it was intimately involved in my own medical scare. So the point of boric acid is actually to kind of be a nuclear bomb in your vagina and kind of level the whole ecosystem. And the ecosystem is a really important mixture of microbes that protect you from the outside world and invaders and things like tampons and bacteria and sperm and stuff that could throw off your balance. And we are basically at the point where we've kind of characterized a lot of healthy vaginal microbiomes, and we're trying now to disrupt for people who have recurrent infections. We're trying to kind of optimize the microbiome, like terraforming a planet. And that takes a lot of baseline knowledge about what that environment is. So we're just starting that work. And just like the gut microbiome, I think this is going to have huge health consequences for millions of people. And I really want to hear more about that. And the last thing is, so the clitoris It has an incredibly long and storied history, and many men have claimed to discover it and give it anatomical names. And most recently, there was a urologist who is kind of credited with fully mapping the clitoris, which I get into in the book. There is some nuance. But there's still a ton to be discovered. We actually haven't even fully counted up the nerves in the clitoris, contrary to popular belief. And there are now doctors who are often working in the realm of trans surgeries and queer care, who are finally getting some of this baseline knowledge about how the clitoris works, what its nerve structure is like, and kind of how it does its beautiful, amazing things that it does. And I also am eating popcorn over here, waiting to hear back the results.
Rachel E. Gross is a science journalist and author of the book, Vagina Obscura.